Are you ready, Matt? Well, welcome back, everyone. This is going to be fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always fun. It's fun for me. I know the students have a good time, and I love hearing the feedback afterward and what people are getting out of every class. Yeah. This should be different because we've been laying 5 weeks of foundation. Yeah. And this now is going to be our first week of jumping right into the text and not just looking at the filters and everything we covered to get to this point. And so I will refresh your memory briefly. We had the five stools with the writing on them, which you couldn't read with the cameras. And everybody was asking, what did they say? What did they say? And if you go through the notes in the presidential letter that I just emailed out this week, they include my notes, which includes what is written on those five chairs. If also, as we go along, the way that we're going to do this is different than a typical Bible school or seminary will have what is called a survey of the Old Testament and a survey of the New Testament. The concept is that you start in Genesis and go through Malachi, and that would be the Old Testament survey, and you would cover the basic storyline, the timeline through the Old Testament, and then the basic timeline, storyline through the New Testament. Except we are going to approach this differently. The way that we're approaching it is with those five stools was laying out the five major covenants and the canon of literature that surrounds it, whether it's the music, the poetry, the histories. So we're not approaching this in a typical survey fashion where you go straight through the timeline or the storyline, which can be helpful. It can be good in the sense that you're picking up the stories, the main content, the numbers, the geography, all of that good stuff. But you sometimes miss the real core of what it's about, which is the five major covenants. So this is a very different approach. It's extremely unique approach to doing this that's different than just simply a survey. Surveys are really good too, though. So what we have on the board today, and I'll read these off because there's a lot written there, is the Noahic Covenant. That was our first stool. And a lot of people, they start with their survey and they spend a lot of time on the Garden of Eden because the Garden of Eden is so rich and there's so much you can look at and it's just fascinating. And so I understand why there's a lot of time spent there, but for the sake of our time, we're going to approach this in a different way where we're not actually going to spend a lot of time on the garden itself. There have been endless sermons and messages, and we could go from 1,000 different angles. What we do have here is what was written on the stool is the Noahic Covenant, and I put numbers next to this because these are chapters 1 through 11. Chapter 1 through 11 is what makes up the canon of Noah's covenant. Now, Noah's covenant appears in chapter 9. God makes covenant and Noah gets drunk. That's what our notes say. So we'll back up, though. those are not directly corresponding, but anyway, wow, I didn't really mean to read that off. So we have here chapter 1. Chapter 1, if you'd like to follow along, Genesis chapter 1, and we're just going to briefly overview, and then we'll back up. But Genesis chapter 1 is the 7 days of creation. It goes through all seven. You get to the end of the chapter, and God rested. Chapter 2 is the creation of mankind, and I didn't have the space for it, in greater detail. In greater detail. They do the 7 days, and man's created on the 6th day, and then the 7th day he rests. Then in chapter 2, he backs up and gives you all this detail about day 6 and the creation of mankind. Chapter 3 is the fall, the always rich story of the serpent and the temptation and all of that. Chapter 4, they're outside the garden now, and you have Cain and Abel, and then after that you have Seth, so you have that whole situation. And then chapter 5, you have a lineage or a genealogy from Adam to Noah. Then you have chapter 6. It talks about this wickedness that had just filled the whole earth. Then you have Noah shows up on the scene. And then God tells Noah about the flood and gives him a promise that he's going to give him a covenant. Chapter 7 is the journey inside of the ark during the flood, landing, all of that. Chapter 8 picks up on that story by it encapsulates the landing and them coming out. You know, they're sending out the raven, they're sending out the dove, they're doing all of that. Chapter 9, God makes covenant with Noah. See, back in chapter 6, he promises him a covenant. Chapter 9, he fulfills the promise and makes covenant with him. Then you have this story of Noah getting drunk. And chapter 10, you have the lineage of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Those are the three sons of Noah. And then chapter 11 is the Tower of Babel and another lineage from Shem, one of the three sons of Noah, to Abram. Chapter 12 picks up with Abram, and that's where our next covenant canon begins. And so we won't go to chapter 12. We'll just stay within chapter 1 and 11 tonight, and that's where we're going to focus. There's a lot in here, and I'm not going to pull out the traditional stuff that is usually focused on in the fall. And I say traditional, and I just wonder, too, because based on the tradition of what I've experienced in church, you may have heard different messages growing up in a different denomination, in a different part of the world. So it could be a very different tradition, but what I've grown up around, which would be some of the Calvinism that I talked about a couple weeks ago, one of the things they emphasize is the depravity of man. One of the parts of the tulip is the total depravity of man. That's the T of the tulip. And so the total depravity of man goes into this concept here and says man's fall, that when he fell, man became completely evil. From top to bottom, everything you do, all the time, always evil, totally depraved. With that concept of total depravity also comes the original sin concept, which came from Augustine, right? Now, Augustine, what he came up with was this concept that I explained about original sin. Original sin being that because you have intercourse, that is naturally, inherently evil, according to him, and therefore original sin is always passed to the next generation. That concept, though, we looked at how Cain, he is told that sin is outside of him, and he must master it. We're going to look at that just a little bit more, and then we'll keep going. But with the background that I grew up with, you would focus a lot on the fall. You would focus on how dispensationalism, this was a change in dispensation, that you had perfection of the garden, and then he fell, and that's the end of the first dispensation. Then you'd jump and you'd have this story, blah, 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 and then you get down to the ark, and now man is going to go through the flood, and another dispensation is going to start. And so the history of at least the background as an American traditional denomination type Christian would get would sort of jump through this story in different ways. But there's pieces that don't really fit in here very well inside of those filters. So we're going to start with the Cain and Abel. We're going to look at that. So go to chapter 4 with me, and we'll take a look here together. Genesis chapter 4. So in Genesis chapter 4, the Lord is speaking to Cain, and he says in verse 6, "Then the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? If you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it.'" That's the picture that really is in stark contrast with the idea of original sin. Otherwise, God would have to say something more clear like, sin is at the core of who you are. It resides at the very middle of your being. This is who you truly are. That would be more fitting with the original sin concept, except here he's saying, look, it's outside of you, and you must rule over it. How could he even say you must rule over it if he doesn't have any ability to, because he's totally depraved? If he's absolutely, totally depraved, this is a not even a real suggestion to offer. It would be cruelty. It would be mean for the Lord to be saying to him, you have to rule over it, but you can't. See what I'm saying? This is a real issue. So we have to step back from some of our doctrines that have been created thousands of years later and injected into this to, at that time in history, nobody had ever been murdered even. I mean, you're talking about a time in history where the sin was that they ate the forbidden fruit. So they end up living outside the garden. And Cain and Abel are both offering a sacrifice, trying to bring a sacrifice to God, and it's not accepted from Cain. Now, that's a whole nother story we're not going to get into tonight. We're going to stay on certain points, but the fact is, they had not gone very far from the garden at this point. And he's simply saying, look, if you do what is right, you'll be accepted. There is no covenant at this point. There's no law at this point. There's no, other than the one rule they had gotten previously, don't eat the fruit, and then they did. Now they can't even eat the fruit again because the cherubim is guarding the garden. They literally have no law at this point. So they have no law. Now, it's an interesting thought, too, as far as I used to think, wow, would Cain even know what death is? Had he ever even seen death? Well, yes, after the fall, the Lord kills a goat and gives the skins to replace the fig leaves that Adam and Eve had been wearing. So there had been some level of death. There's also the question of whether death existed before the fall. Now, most traditional Christian thinking says that there was no death until the fall of Adam and Eve in the garden. But let's think this through, because it says, in the day that you eat of this, you will surely die. That doesn't mean that there was no death. It means there was no human death. That's what we clearly see from it so far, that there was no human death. Because if you think about even just the way that ecology and biology is set up in this world, for example, there's one theologian who also has a wildlife biology degree, and he studied this out, and one of the things he came up with is that if there was no death, that within 50 years, the entire land of planet Earth would be covered 2 feet high with rabbits. That's if there's no death in any way. 50 years, 2 feet high, every bit of planet Earth would be covered with rabbits. Plus, you have all these animals that have these sharp, carnivorous teeth, and their whole body is built to eat meat. Their whole body is built this way. Plus, if you have animals that are herbivores, they are going to go and they're going to eat plants. Well, when you eat a plant, the plant dies. So there's a form of death, even just in the vegetarian animals. So there's some kind of death that's going on, except that the guardians and keepers of the garden, those who are called to subdue the earth, to overtake it, all of that, they have been given a certain form of life that doesn't include death until the fall. Whereas there could have been animal and plant death previously. Now, that won't help you or get you a cup of coffee, but it is very interesting to me. So we have a difference there, that man was given a certain form of life that the rest of creation was not given, and it was given optionally, and we gave up our option on that. So we have Cain and Abel. Sin is outside of Cain, and what I want to do is I want to show you over in Romans chapter 5. This is where a lot of theologians connect original sin to Cain and Abel, or to Adam and Eve, actually. So in Romans chapter 5, starting in verse 12, "Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, which would be Adam, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all people because all sinned." This is like the worst pyramid scheme in human history. So you have Adam, Adam sins, through sin, death enters the world, through death it comes to all mankind. Everybody in the downstream is getting death out of this deal. Not good. Then we have verse 13, "To be sure, sin was in the world before the law was given." What's the law? The law is the old covenant. That is a synonym with the old covenant. The old covenant is the Mosaic covenant. So Paul's just pointing back and he's saying, look, sin was in the world before the Mosaic covenant came along. And notice from our Bible chronology a couple weeks ago that we talked about the timeline, that there's at least 2,417 years from Adam until Joseph dies and they're in Egypt, which I thought about that a little more. When you add the 430 years that they were in Egypt, it brings you up to 2,847 years. So, to put that in perspective, 2,847 years from Adam until the Exodus out of Egypt, where they then receive the law. That means that almost 3,000 years on earth, there was no law. There was no old covenant law system. That's a really long time when compared with the 1,300 years that there was a Mosaic covenant. So, putting that in perspective, that to be sure, sin was in the world before the law was given, but sin was not charged against anyone's account where there is no law. Sin is not charged against anyone's account where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses. That'd be 2,847 years. Even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam, who is the pattern of the one to come. So he's saying here, there's no law in existence, but death still reigned. Even though there was no law system, death still reigned. And it reigned over those, even those who sinned, but they didn't sin by breaking a commandment. There was no command, so there's no sin being charged against their account. But the gift, now it's talking, jumping thousands of years into the future in our timeline of our mind. It's talking about Jesus coming and his death and resurrection. But the gift is not like the trespass. Now it's going to begin to contrast Adam with Christ. But the gift is not like the trespass. For if the many died by the trespass, which would be of Adam, of the one man, how much more did God's grace and the gift that came by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to the many? So in the same way that Adam has this pyramid scheme going on where everybody in his downline receives death, Jesus shows up and the gift is so much more than what Adam had, that in Jesus' downline, everybody gets grace all the way down. It overflows to the many. Nor can the gift of God be compared with the result of one man's sin. Now he's going to contrast this. The judgment followed one sin and brought condemnation, but the gift followed many trespasses and brought justification. So the condemnation came after just one sin, but the gift was able to nullify the power of thousands and thousands and millions of sins over several thousands of years. If by the trespass of the one man, death reigned through that one man, So by Adam, death was given the power to reign. How much more will those who receive God's abundant provision of grace, the gift of righteousness, reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ? Romans 5:17 is probably one of my most favorite verses. I mean, that is just incredible. If by the trespass of the one man death reigned through that one man, how much more will those who receive God's abundant provision of grace and the gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ? It's a big deal. So I was going to draw you something here, and I don't have a lot of space for it, and I do have to flip the whiteboard to my other notes, so we'll leave it on this side. But we have a little stick figure here, and under him we have a whole bunch of stick figures, and yeah, there we go. We'll put four there. And we got this going on. It's going down. This is the idea of original sin. Original sin gets passed from the one into all these people. The concept that I'm drawing out for us here is that we have our one stick figure up top, and a planet. This is my really bad version of planet Earth right there. Yep, that's it. So we have a planet, and we have two different concepts. So the original sin concept is it gets passed from the one man down through the bloodline, or down through the family lineage, the way that Augustine came up with. But what we see in Romans chapter 5, this is what I'd like to show us, and now that I've closed my Bible to Romans chapter 5, because I wanted to be practical. In Romans chapter 5, verse 12, therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all people because all sinned. I think that there's something really subtle here that we have to see, that instead of it saying, therefore, just as sin entered world family or the lineage of man or something like that, which would fit with this, it's as if you have Adam and Eve, and we're just putting one up here as the progenitor of the race. You have here the representation of the very first. So you have Adam, and Adam and Eve are given the rulership over planet Earth. You're to subdue it. You're to multiply, fill the earth. They're given this role. And so what they do as the rulers of it, they are literally like the keepers of planet Earth. They could choose to let sin into the atmosphere or keep it out. And when they sin, they invite in death. Death comes into the world. It comes into humanity's world. So here we have, just as sin entered the world through one man. Because that man is the gatekeeper, he allowed sin to enter the world. And death through sin. So by his sin, death came in. And in this way, death came to all people because all sinned. What we see happening is that he allows it into the atmosphere of planet Earth. Now, every single person at some point in their life will choose to step into sin, whether that's at 3 years old or 10 years old or whatever place in life they begin to actually choose willfully to rebel, to actually walk in sin. That is where it enters into their life, rather than it enters in through birth. The concept of sinning in the womb, or the act of intercourse, creating sin through the bloodline, things like that, that really have a real tenuous hold on Scripture. There's not much to actually put that together there. But the reality here is that Romans chapter 5 actually paints this picture much more clearly, that he, as the ruler over creation, gives the gateway and opens the door for sin into the earth, which brings with it death. And now that it's in the atmosphere, people will grow up and they will at some point choose to sin. They will open the door like Cain did. And that's the process that we see here. This is, I don't know that this specifically has a theological name for this belief, but this is actually held by a lot of theologians. Most of the books that try to describe it are very large, and I don't recommend that we try to jump into them because they can be overwhelming, and the language is very analytical. There is one that I would recommend if someone is very curious to look more at the Romans 5 connection with the creation and with this whole concept of original sin. This one's called Precious in His Sight. Precious in His Sight, A Fresh Look at the Nature of Humanity. This is a Harold Eberle book. You'll notice if you've been paying close attention to all the books that I recommend, I have a lot of Gregory Boyd and a lot of Harold Eberle. Harold Eberle is a dear friend of mine, very close friend, and I consider him tremendously, tremendously brilliant. Most people consider him to be that, and he's written about 30 books. So there's a lot of topics I could recommend a book from him on, and they're very user-friendly. Even though he's deep, deep theologian, he has a very user-friendly writing style. So these are the two contrasts here of what actually happens when this comes in. Now, I'm going to have to... All right, I'll give you like one more minute on this topic, and then we'll go on. I wrote on the board the first class about systematic theology, a phrase called atonement theory. At some point, we can get into it more. I held up the book, J.W.C. Wan's book, Nine Different Views. I talked about there's someone else out there who told me there's a book with 29 different views. So it's a really big, broad topic. This concept that I just described here with letting sin into the earth and man being the reigner and gatekeeper is a part of the view. See, atonement theory got really confused in about the 1100s AD, but the first 1,000 years of Christianity, there was essentially one view on the atonement. Then it went wild. It got even crazier in the 1500s with the Reformation, but the one view is called the Christus Victor view. Christus is Christ, and then the letters U-S, Christus Victor. The concept is that Adam and Eve were given the keys that they could reign and rule over planet Earth, subdue, fill, multiply, all of that. And that when they fell into the temptation, they gave the keys, they gave their authority away to the devil. The devil then reigned and ruled under the power of sin and death until Jesus came as a man, as the new Adam, to live as the second Adam and to take back the keys of death and Hades from the devil, and he is Christ is victor. And that was the view for the first 1,000 years until a man named Anselm of Canterbury came along and presented a new view that then began to splinter off into a lot of new views. So, like I said, I'll give you 1 minute. There we go. We have to move on. But this view connects with the main view of the atonement that existed for the first 1,000 years of Christianity. It's not an odd view. It's the historical view. So we have Genesis chapter 1, the 7 days. Then we have the creation in detail of mankind. We have the fall. We have Cain and Abel. We talked a little bit about Cain and Abel. Another thing in Genesis chapter 4 that we're going to touch real briefly here. In Genesis chapter 4, we have another descendant named Lamech. So you have Cain, and then after Cain, you have Lamech. And we don't know a whole lot about him, But what we have is in chapter 4, verse 19, Lamech married two women. It's an interesting phrase. It's the first time we have something of its sort in the Bible. We reach the fourth chapter, and this is where you have it. The great temptation in the garden, the great fight between Cain and Abel, you don't have sexual tension. It's just not there. That's not what it's about. Fruit. It's about envy and murder. It's those things. But now you have this interesting thing. It just sort of pops out of nowhere, and you don't notice it if you're not being very careful as you read through that. Verse 19, Lamech married two women. It's the first polygamy that's going on. So you have him marrying two women. But notice, a little bit further down, you get down to verse 23, Lamech said to his wives, and then it has this quote, Ada and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. Here's the connection that I just want to make real briefly and let you ponder it from here, is that Lamech, what you have here that he's describing is an intense, intense level of bitterness. So he's dealing with some really heavy bitterness. He kills a person for wounding him, a young man for injuring him. And then he declares a curse over himself. God doesn't even show up and declare this. He declares over himself, Cain avenged seven times, Lamech 77 times. So he puts this thing over himself. And he's living under this tremendous bitterness. To connect that, What I see here, and I've just seen this, I put this in the Eyes of Honor book as well, is that I believe that there's a link between his polygamy and the bitterness in his heart. It says Jesus in the Gospels is saying about Moses gave you a certificate of divorce for your hardness of heart. I think that's such a good picture of why divorce happens. There's some kind of hardness of heart. It might be one party, it might be both parties, but if you have two people who have soft hearts, most often they're able to work things out. If they both are willing to have open, soft hearts, you can work through things. But when hardness is there, in either one or both, when there's hardness, there's a closing. And that's why Moses had to give a certificate of divorce, because of hardness of heart. And we have here Lamech, first man who has two women. Why? Because he's so embittered that one is just not going to satisfy. One is not going to be okay for him because he lives in that kind of bitterness. And I just want to say this to any of the guy students. This is something to ponder, whether this is a part of why you might struggle with sexual temptation or lust or pornography or whatever it is, that this can be a big piece of it, is having a closed heart or hard heart or even just having bitterness. Because when you have that bitterness and it closes off the relationship between you and your spouse, then this is what happens, is you then turn to more than one wife. Now, back then, they didn't have the internet and pornography, so he has two women. So it's just, we have to think through what's actually going on in the story, not just trying to gather facts, but actually seeing how is this developing? What's going on? The first man who has more than one wife, why? All we know about him is he's crazy bitter. He'll kill someone for wounding him. So we have an anger problem too. So we have this story here. It's just sort of a side story about Lamech. Then we have Adam to Noah and the lineage. Now, just looking at the time, we're going to take our break right now, and we'll pick up on the lineage as soon as we come back. So thank you very much. Thank you.
said in Romans that we are to reign in life. Many of us have accepted a life far below what would be described as reigning. It is time to rise up as powerful people.
All right, welcome back. All right, as we said, we're going to pick up on Genesis chapter 5. We just very briefly passed through 1, 2, 3, 4. And then you have Genesis chapter 5. Now, if you're like most normal people, you get to a chapter like Genesis chapter 5, and you just glaze right over. I mean, it's like, oh, you have just hit your first genealogy. Welcome to the Bible. You're like, oh, wow, only five chapters in. So this is the written account of Adam's family line. God created mankind when he made them in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them. And he named them mankind when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image. He named him Seth. After Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years, had other sons and daughters. Although Adam lived for a total of 930 years, and then he died. Etc., etc., etc. And we've all run into this. I mean, there's a whole book called Numbers. And this is why a lot of us shy away, and we kind of go to the New Testament. And we like to start with the Christmas story and move into the miracles, and I mean, it's easy. But part of this is a cultural thing, and we've been talking previous weeks about the historical contextual hermeneutic. So we have here, these are the names. If you read through chapter 5, and I've really abbreviated it, you have Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, you probably heard of Enoch, Methuselah, you heard of him too, Lamech, a different Lamech, they didn't have a whole lot of names figured out yet, and that's my guess, and then you have Noah. So if you were to read through this, when you read through it, you'll find these names. You'll find that they had kids. You'll find that they lived this many years, then they had kids, then they lived this many years, and then they died. And you're like, ah, I don't get it. What's with all this information? Part of it is that we are not seeing this through the original language, and we don't even know to look for it because we're just glazing over. So if we were to take each of these names and look at what they mean and then line up the genealogy, this is what you'd see. Adam means man. Seth means appointed. Enosh means mortal. Kenan means sorrow. Mahalalel means the blessed God. Jared means to come down. Enoch means teaching. Methuselah means his death shall bring. Lamech means the weary. Noah means rest. So a Hebrew person reading this in their Torah is going to see man appointed mortal sorrow, the blessed God to come down teaching, his death shall bring the weary rest. These boring genealogies are not always as boring as we think they are. It's so easy to pass over this when you have no idea, and to dig this out is so much work. I actually have, in my book, Normal Christianity, there's a chapter called The Land of Wimpy Prayers, and in that chapter, I detail out the same thing I have written on the board here, as well as the passage and all of this, and it is one of the things I get emails all the time. How did you find the names and the meanings and what they are? And I went back to one of the sources because I heard this probably 15 years ago, and I had to go back and find where it was. And this may be the first time you ever hear me, and maybe the last time you ever hear me recommend something from Chuck Missler. But Chuck Missler put this same thing, researched out in detail on his Koinonia Koinonia Calvary Chapel website, wherever you find it on the internet. Chuck Missler has actually detailed out and done the research. And as far as researching original root words, he's very good at that. And he's probably in his late 70s, early 80s, highly reputed person for knowing how to do some of this. And so you may not find the exact same meanings for all of these names if you tried to do the research, but you could look up that article from him if you want to find the endnotes. So, Genesis chapter 5, this is what you have. Man appointed mortal sorrow, the blessed God to come down teaching, his death shall bring the weary rest. It is a messianic prophecy in the names of the generations from Adam to Noah. Stunning. So, you got this going on, but then they don't see the big picture. I mean, you get down to, let's say, Enoch, and he's thinking, okay, I'm teaching. He might be able to trace out this much, but he doesn't know the rest of the story. I think it's really interesting when you get to Methuselah, who is the oldest recorded living person in the Bible. And when you look at his, he's getting up into his 960s. He's getting pretty old. And his name means his death shall bring. What? Bring what? What does that mean? So for almost 1,000 years, he's like, what is it going to happen when I die? And he has no idea what the story, where it's going. And notice, this is fascinating. Okay, so Methuselah, the year that he dies is the same year that God shuts the door of the ark and the flood happens. So it's probably Noah over here, next couple generations down, building the ark, looking at Methuselah going, his death shall bring. And he's probably connecting the dots. Like, it's going to bring probably something I'm working on here. It's going to bring the end of this world that I just heard God tell me, build an ark. I'm going to destroy the planet. His death shall bring. We've been waiting almost 1,000 years to find out what it's going to bring. Might have something to do with this giant flood thing that's coming. So Noah might be looking at him going, don't die yet, don't die yet. Just hang in there, a few more. But the year that he dies, the flood occurs. So this whole thing, it has a lot of pieces to it. You know, Enoch is the famous one. He walked with God and had sons and daughters. I love the fact that when you read it, it says, Enoch walked with God and had sons and daughters. Because this is verse 22, chapter 5, verse 22. After he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked faithfully with God 300 years and had other sons and daughters. And then the famous verse is verse 24. Enoch walked faithfully with God, then he was no more because God took him away. People talk about maybe he was just like a one-man rapture, basically. And so that concept, which I think is good. I'm for that. So you have here this Enoch thing, and but I heard someone point out, and I thought it was such a good little point, and it stuck with me, that Enoch walked with God and had sons and daughters, and that he wasn't like a hermit, and he wasn't like out in a cave by himself as some sort of mystic, but that he's married, he has kids, and he walks faithfully with the Lord for 300 years. There's something about that he's a family man who's walking with God in such a way that he gets translated into the Spirit and is no more. Rather than you know, emphasizing he's like a holy man out in the caves by himself and eating, you know, a certain type of mystical diet or whatever, but that he's a family man, and then he's gone. I just thought that was a great little point I heard some years ago. Really like that. So we have the lineage and this sort of secret code buried in there. Genesis chapter 6 has been extremely studied. There's lots of terrible books out about the Nephilim. You can look them up or don't, I would recommend. And there are a lot of terrible books about Nephilim and how, you know, it's an end time world system, blah, 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 giants in the land. I love mystical things like that as far as looking into the dinosaurs and fossil records. And, you know, I can have discussions about pre-Adamic race and gap theory and all this stuff. But when it comes down to it, when we overemphasize one really small portion like that that doesn't even directly have to do with redemptive history, is just a piece of biblical history, you can end up in a lot of weird stuff and focusing on things that really lead you down some weird paths of how you approach life. And so I'm going to caution you with the Nephilim stuff. The thing that's interesting in this passage, there's a lot, but one of the things I'll note is where in Genesis 6, verse 6, the Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. The Lord said, I will wipe the face of the earth, the human from the face of the earth, the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. That would be verse 6 and verse 7, where he says, I regret. And then in verse 6, he says, regretting. That would be a real clear passage where a Calvinist would say that's an anthropomorphism. Because if God is timeless, he's outside of time, and he sees everything, there's no way he could experience the sorrow that's described here, where his heart is grieved, because he knew it was coming. He predestined it. He caused it to happen. Kind of weird to regret something that you caused to happen. So that would be one of those really clear examples of God actually being a part of what's going on, and he gets to that point, and he goes, whew, this is not turning out as I thought it would. And these people are being completely, unbelievably evil to each other and to this planet that I created, and I'm regretting this, and his heart is deeply troubled. I like some of the other ones that says it was grieved or it was filled with sorrow. There's more emotion to it. The thing, too, that I want to add here with the flood, this is the picture of what was going on from God's perspective, and this is his heart. And from his perspective, the flood is not coming out of the furious anger of a wrathful God. That's not happening here. And there's been confusion because people see the flood, they see Sodom and Gomorrah, they see the Tower of Babel, and through a lens of the old covenant which brought wrath, they see it as the wrath of God. The flood is not the wrath of God. It's that the whole system had gotten so evil that it needed to be cleansed because there's so much unbelievable amount of evil going on that he's wiping the face of the earth. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So he has this Noah, and he's going to do this plan that we're all somewhat familiar with. And if you're not, you can either read two chapters, or in May, you can go see a two-hour movie about it. Yes, Russell Crowe, yes. So we have chapter 6, and then it continues. He's talking to Noah, and he tells him to build an ark. And just for laughs, if you get a chance, you should go on YouTube and type in Bill Cosby and Noah's Ark. Amazing. Noah, build me an ark. Build you a what? An ark. It's a great sketch. Let's see. In chapter 6, verse 18, he says, "But I will establish my covenant with you." That would be a place to underline or highlight. He's given him the promise, I will establish my covenant with you. That's chapter 6, near the end of chapter 6. You don't hear about that covenant again until you get to chapter 9, verse 9. I now establish my covenant with you and your descendants after you. So you have this big piece of all the activity that goes on in between it. So you have Genesis chapter 7. Let me just flip back for a minute here. We're going to use the other side so you can continue to follow along. Genesis chapter 7, you have the story of them inside the ark. Chapter 8, they land the ark and then they come out. Genesis 9, he makes a covenant with Noah. And that's sort of the centerpiece of the story, is making the covenant with him. Notice also, we're going to pick up together, passing over chapter 7, chapter 8, picking up in chapter 9. Chapter 9, he starts with, we're going to start with chapter 9, verse 7. As for you, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply on the earth and increase upon it. Remember that? Sounds pretty familiar. It actually is kind of a throwback to Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, where he gave a very similar command to Adam and Eve. Except notice here, he says, be fruitful, increase in number, multiply. Those are basically the same thing. And increase upon it. So he says increase basically four different ways. Multiply, be fruitful, increase, increase. But he doesn't say subdue it. Why? Because Adam already gave away the reigning and ruling aspect of what he had. Death was still in the atmosphere. Christ as victor hadn't happened yet. Noah didn't have the authority that Adam had. Noah is much, much less in the level of what he's walking in. The best that he's now commissioned to do is go, now that you're being commissioned, go and populate the earth. But the original mission included subdue and cultivate, and that is not happening here. Also, there's no garden. Up until the flood, there's a garden in Eden. But there's no garden anymore because the flood wiped everything out. And there's also debate back and forth, and I could really be convinced either way. I don't see that there's a problem with either position necessarily, whether it was a local flood, because the language in the English makes it sound like it covered the whole face of the earth, killed everything. But sometimes the English translation is not accurate to the Hebrew writing. In the same way that it is in Matthew 24, it uses these words that make it sound like go preach the gospel to the whole world, but the word for whole world is local inhabited earth, which is basically the opposite of whole world. So here it could be that the flood is localized to a giant region that kills everything in that area because man hadn't spread very far from the garden. In that time period, man's right there. You could kill all of them by throwing a rock across town. It's basically what's going on. But we also know that on the side of the fossil records, there are records of a flood on every continent, everywhere on the earth, that show the strata and all of that. So geologically, it could be proven the other direction, that there was a worldwide flood. Or the part where it says, the fountains of the deep were broken up. The whole idea of a one continent Pangaea being broken into many continents that spread because of a worldwide global flood is very possible. All of that is sort of a side note, but just to lay out the concept, because there's lots and lots of debate over that story of the flood, which direction do we take it? Do we say literal? Do we say worldwide? Is it a figure? Is it a metaphor? I think it's literal, but I also don't know the scope of it because I think it's still up for debate, and I think you're orthodox either position that you take on it, but it definitely killed everybody. And does that mean that the flood was in Alaska? It really only needed to hit the Middle East to kill everybody at that time in history. So it's debatable. Now, regardless, we're picking up, as we said, in chapter 9. And I guess my point there was just to say the garden is gone. Those four rivers that we heard about in chapter, the first chapter last week, the four rivers, although the Tigris and the Euphrates continue to show up through the book of Genesis, the rivers are probably in a different location than they were previously. Something there even has been shifted. So everything has shifted around. Now, let's add a couple other thoughts. A lot of us have heard this statement that the age of man, this comes from Genesis chapter 6, verse 3. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. Have any of you ever heard people say that's when he limited mankind's age and you can't live past 120 years? Okay, I thought it was something we've all heard. It's true. So we've all heard that at some point, and that concept comes from that verse, except that verse is not saying that in any way. What he's actually saying in this verse is he's declaring when he's going to flood and kill everyone. Look at the verse again. The Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever. They are mortal. Their days," meaning their remaining days till I kill them, "will be 120 years. He's declaring when it's going down, when the human race is going down. The reason we know that that's what he's saying is because he, immediately after the flood, we have these people that are living, including the descendants. Let's see, I have this written in my other notes here. I didn't get a chance to type them all up, but I will get them in there. In Genesis chapter 10, verse 25, we have a descendant of Noah named Peleg, and he lives 239 years. 239 years. This concept of old age and hundreds of years continues after the flood, even though in Genesis 6 he says he's limited the age of man. Because he's not saying, "I've limited how long a man can live." He's actually saying in Genesis 6, "You have this many years left before the destruction comes." So that is just a common, you could just call that myth-busting for right there. Just some myth-busting. I was trying to work it out. I didn't get it finished in time and the calculations for you. But I was also working on how long it took to build the ark based on Noah's age, the time the flood came, when he got the command, because I think a lot of people also think that it took 120 years to build the ark. I came up somewhere around about 75 years, and I would have put it on the whiteboard, but I was working on it literally to the last second until I had to jump in the car to get here tonight. Didn't get it finished for you, so I might have that in the future if I can finish figuring it out exactly. Well, let's keep going. A couple chapters left to touch on, and time is against us, as always, in this class. Not always. So, we have here the sons of Noah. This is, they've come out. God says he's going to make a covenant. The covenant he makes with Noah, I talked about this briefly earlier in one of the other sessions, that you have Noah who has just gone through rain, which has never occurred before. It happens for 40 solid days. Everything he knows, everyone he knows is dead, except for immediate family and some animals on the boat with him. So you have a probably very traumatized family here. They get out of the boat finally, and they're about to start over. And Noah goes and builds a vineyard and gets drunk, which may be connected to the trauma he's just gone through. I'm not sure. Just a thought there, humorously thinking. But the other thought is that God comes and gives him a covenant. And the covenant he gives is that he's not going to do this again. That not only is an amazing promise in general for humanity, but I think it also speaks very personally to the heart of Noah, who's just gone through this traumatic experience. That every time now that a rain cloud shows up and starts to drizzle, he's thinking, do I need to go get back on the boat, go get the cats, get the dog, leave the spiders, let's go. And he's probably traumatized. And so God is saying, look, it's not going to happen again. We're not going to do that again. And so this is a huge comforting moment for Noah. Like, oh, good, cool, glad to hear it. And for his kids and for his family. They can now begin to do this command. Multiply, be fruitful, increase. It's hard to do that when you're constantly living in fear of every raindrop being another flood and killing everybody. And so, okay, peace comes into his heart again. Okay, we can start to do this planet again. No problem. So they begin this process, and the covenant is made, and it's the rainbow. When you see the rainbow, there will be a promise that he's never going to do this again. Now, part of that, too, may be in the sense that even though God has wiped evil off the earth, he hasn't regenerated anybody. So he's not just going to keep hitting the reset button. He's basically saying, look, I'm not going to do that again. We're going to move forward, be fruitful, multiply, let's keep going. And he already promised back in Genesis 3:15 that there would be a offspring that would crush the head of the serpent. He already prophesied that big thing in chapter 5 with the genealogy, a messianic prophecy. So the Lord is saying, look, I'm not going to do it that way ever again. I'm wiping the cloth, I'm wiping the whole system. We're starting over, but in the future, we'll do it a different way. Is implied in the background. It's not in the promise itself, but it's implied in the background that they're going to take care of this issue, but not through destroying, but it'll be fixed in a different way, but not through utter destruction. So we have Genesis chapter 9. You have this story after he gets drunk. He plants a vineyard. He gets drunk. He has three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And Ham is the one who comes in. He sees his father naked, and there's a mocking that takes place, and this brings a curse on Ham. And then there's a blessing that gets spoken over Shem. In chapter 9, verse 26, it says, we'll just start in verse 24. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done, he said, "Cursed be Canaan," which is another name for Ham, "the lowest of slaves he will be to his brothers." He also said, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend Japheth's territory. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem. And may Canaan be the slave of Japheth." So Ham just got reamed out real bad, really cursed, really, really bad. And his descendants are the Canaanites, who the Israelites are at war with. And if you start to follow these genealogies, Shem is the great, 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 however many greats it is, he is the ancestor of Abram, who's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, and then you have the Israelites that come out of that. So, a thousand or so years later, you have Shem's descendants going in to take the promised land and attacking the descendants of Ham, which are the Canaanites. And they're in a war together. And Ham has been cursed to be a slave. This curse is released over him and all his generations. So you have this curse that goes out. And this is interesting because if you think about this with me, when we hear about the Jewish people, if you're anti-Jewish, we don't say you're anti-Jewish, we say you're anti-Semitic. Semitic is a shortening. It's actually to be Shemitic. That's where this comes from. Because they aren't Semites, they're Shemites. They're descendants of Shem. They're not Abrahamites, they're Shemites. So this is actually Jewish people are descended from Shem. Abraham's descended from Shem, and it continues on down the line. That's where we get that term, Semitic. It's actually Shemites, Shemitic. That's where this comes from. To add to that thought, and this will come in another 10 or 11 classes from now, we'll come back to this, but I'll just throw this out there. Shem outlived Abram by 35 years. When you go through and you work out the genealogy in chapter 11, starting in verse 10, it's in a genealogy from Shem to Abram. And when you work out that genealogy, Shem outlives Abram by 35 years. That becomes important much later in the course. We will come back to that. What else should we touch on? We have chapter 10. Chapter 10 goes into the specific genealogies of Japheth and his sons, Ham and his sons, and then Shem and his sons. Actually, if you look right in chapter 10, verse 21, right before it, sometimes they have these little headers in your Bible, and you might have one there that says, the Semites. It might be there, might not be there. But you have the Shem. And then you have chapter 11. Now, this is where we're going to finish out for tonight, is talking about chapter 11. The mysterious Tower of Babel. So I've been studying this out myself because it's one of those stories that has always been confusing to me as well. And I came up with a lot of very interesting stuff in my research in preparation. And let's just go through it as quickly as we can. I have about 13 quick points to throw to you that will help you catch some of this. And this is why we also email out the videos, so that you can pause, rewind, play again, pause, rewind, play again. But number one, we'll start in chapter 11, verse 1. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, you know what that means now. They found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They're moving eastward. Remember the little stick figure that said bad? He was going this way. Eastward is away from the garden. That is bad. They're moving away from the garden. That is your first clue that this is going to be a problem. They're going away from the garden, point number one. Then in verse 4, we'll keep reading. They said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we'll be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Okay, multiple things in verse 4 to look at here. Number one, they have a desire not to be scattered. That is the opposite of their commission to populate, fill the earth. It is the opposite of what Adam and Eve were told in Genesis 1, verse 28. Is the opposite of what Noah is told in chapter 9, verse 1. They are desiring not to go over the face of the earth. It is the opposite of their commission. Number two is that they want to make a name for themselves. Make a name in the ancient world was basically what we would call today to become a superpower. They wanted to make a name. To make your name great meant that you had big armies, that you had power, basically that you had the power to become oppressor. You had a great name in the earth. So this is alluding to that they are very clearly saying, not even alluding, it's clearly saying that they had a desire to have that kind of power and authority that would be oppressive. So this is a bad thing. Then you have the next part of it you have here, with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves. Now that's an interesting one, because the way that this is phrased and the way that some have come to understand this is not simply that it's saying a tall building that goes up into the sky, or a tall building that we can get to heaven. Like, that's threatening God somehow. Like, oh no, don't get too tall, you'll get up here. And we know that that's not reality. Even, I mean, that's just funny when you think about it. But obviously we have skyscrapers that are, you know, enormous, and this didn't even touch that kind of height. But actually what's being said here is a tower to honor the heavens would be a better way to translate that passage. A tower to honor, not just that reaches, but that honors or lifts up the heavens. Why? What sense does that make? It's actually talking about astrology. It's a tower that will honor the heavens. They're talking about creation worship and astrology here. The way that these ancient towers, they're also called ziggurats, which I've been asked to spell everything because nobody knows how to Google the stuff that I'm saying. And you can look this up. You can see pictures of these. A ziggurat, Z-I-G-G-U-R-A-T-S. Z-I-G-G-U-R-A-T-S. A ziggurat, they're towers. And there's as many, this is what I have in my notes here, there are as many as 25 that have been discovered in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. The most elaborate is on the site of ancient Babylon itself. Now, Babylon is what the later name for Babel. It's the same location. That's an interesting piece as well. So you have here a tower, and the most elaborate one in the region is this ziggurat that is there connected with astrology to honor the heavens. So there's some sort of an occult worship that's going on this early in the whole system. So you have this place. Notice that it says, as we keep going, we have verse 5, but the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the people were building. That's a really funny verse. You may not catch it in the English, but the concept there is a humorous response to the fact that they're trying to build a huge tower to honor the heavens and to reach up toward the heaven. And then it says, and God came down, showing how far he was still above this tower that they were building. That he didn't just kind of like go over to the top of the building and go, wow, you guys built a tall building. It's like next to my mansion. That he had to come down to their puny little tower. It's a mocking that's actually going on in that verse there. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower they were building. Like, pathetic little tower. He had to come all the way down to check it out. Then you have, backing up even just a moment here, in verse 2, we saw that the people moved eastward. They found a plain in Shinar and settled there. Well, what is Shinar? Where did that come from? Well, in chapter 10, verse 10, we have the first centers of his kingdom. Speaking of, this is a descendant of Ham. The first centers of his kingdom were Babylon, Uruk, Akkad, Kaleng, in Shinar. So, who's living in Shinar? The descendants of Ham. So, sign number one, it's in the east. That's a problem. Sign number two, it's in Shinar. That's where those Ham guys live. That's a problem. And they got cursed out by Noah, who has a relationship with God. So instead, they're going this way, and they're worshiping the sky. They're worshiping astrology, and they're going this direction. So you have the sons of Ham are being cursed here. Then, as we said, Babel is the ancient name for Babylon. As we go through the Bible, you begin to see that Babylon is essentially the arch enemy of the Israelites. All through the story, Babylon is the one in 586 that brings the destruction of Jerusalem. It's very, very important. Babylon is a major player and an arch enemy of Jerusalem, but the ancient name is Babel. So this is the same place where the tower is. I'm going to read this out of my notes for you, just it's easier. We have here Adam and Eve tried to become great without God. When you eat of this fruit, you'll be like God. We'll be like God without God's help, without God's intervention. We'll be like him. They forgot that they already were like God, and they tried to be like God outside of relationship. And now Babel is trying to do the same thing by trying to make their name great in some way on their own, trying to do that. And the fascinating thing, and we're jumping into chapter 12, which I said we wouldn't actually do, but in chapter 12, verse 2, God begins to talk to this man named Abram, and the first things he says in verse 2 is, I will make you into a great nation, I will bless you, I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. That is a fascinating promise, because he'll make your name great and you will be a blessing. If Babel had had their name become great, they would not have been a blessing. They're over here worshiping demons with astrology and doing this whole thing, the Ham descendants apart from God, trying to make their own name great, which is what took down Adam and Eve. And God now comes to Abram and says, I'll make your name great. See, these pictures are just amazing, but so often we just read one little piece at a time and we're not getting the full disclosure of what's going on here. Couple more things about this. It's just fascinating. They're in the Tigris-Euphrates River Delta, and so they don't have access at this point to a lot of stone like you would in other places. So you see the invention of bricks and tar to build this tower. So these bricks actually still stand. You have to think with me maybe of like the Egyptian pyramids. They're making the bricks like the Israelite slaves are making hundreds of years later. They're making bricks. Well, they're making bricks in Genesis chapter 11, only that far after the flood. The direct descendants of Ham have figured this out. Noah himself plants a vineyard and is making alcohol. This stuff is being made so early on. There's all these evolutionary concepts that seem to float around in our mind, or maybe it's like old Geico commercials about cavemen. This concept of like, you know, scratching things on the walls of caves, and that they figured out this stone by putting a point on it. Then they had like an early tool, and it's really insulting to our ancestors, because it's talking about them in a way that, well, there are only a couple steps from having been an ape, so now they're figuring out human speech. No, at this point, they all had one language. We're still trying to figure out human speech. They had one language. They're building towers up into the sky, giant ziggurats, and even before the flood, you have Noah builds a giant boat with tar and gopher wood and this whole thing that he's building that is incredible, that people still think, how did they build it in that day? We will see when the movie comes out. But but that's not the Paleolithic caveman who's evolving and getting taller and getting a bigger brain and trying to figure everything out and all this nonsense that we've learned from evolution that has no basis in reality. This is actually very intelligent people from day one who are figuring this out on their own, and they are understanding things way earlier than some of us may have thought about. So they're getting this figured out really early. So Couple last points on this. They're making brick, ziggurats. The other thing, this is one more piece on this. You have Babel, which is a compound of two words. B-A-B, Bab, which means gate, and El, E-L, which means God. So this word, Babel, actually means gate of God. But when he confuses the language, it says in chapter 11, verse 9, this is why it was called Babel, and there's a little notation there, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So there's something of two different meanings here. There's a meaning that says it's confusion, but then there's actual, the literal meaning is the gate of God. So they're trying to build a ziggurat, a tower, which would be a gate between heaven and earth. The time period and what we understand, the historians have come to understand, is that the way they would build these is they would leave a platform on top and there'd be a shrine there. And the concept was that the God who lives in the sky would come and land in the shrine and he would speak to the high priest. And the high priest would get the word of the Lord, would get the prophecy, and he would direct the people from there. Now, whether that was actually happening demonically or whether that was just used to manipulate the people, it could be either, could be both. But this was what was going on. And so this tower of the gate of God is what it's being called. It ends up being the tower of confusion where the languages gets confused. But notice, this is also a mockery of the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden was the place where heaven and earth met, that God came and walked and talked with them in the cool of the garden, and now they're trying to build a new place where God will come and meet with them, but their God on their terms, in their way. And later, in Genesis 28, you have God meets with Jacob, and he shows him the not the gate of God, the house of God, which is not Babel, Beth-El. So he wakes up and he says, God was in this place and I did not even know it. It's a place he puts his head down on the rock and he falls asleep and he sees the vision of the ladder going into heaven, and it is Beth-El, the house of God. So over here he has Babel, the Tower of Babel, which is the gate of God, man trying to figure this thing out, astrology, trying to reach God in their own way. And over in Bethel, when Jacob shows up there, there's no temple. He literally finds a rock to put his head on to sleep that night. Just lays down exhausted and goes to sleep, and then God meets him. Shows quite a difference between the God of Babel in the sense of having a big temple and all this man ritualistic worship, versus the God who you didn't even know he was there and he just shows up and you have an encounter with him. And that is the God of Bethel. That is the true God. And Redding, California. But it's the God of Bethel. Two last things. There's a verse in Zephaniah, which you should all know where that is because you're probably just reading that. In Zephaniah chapter 3, go to Daniel and then keep going right. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 9 says, and this is a prophecy about the future after the exile and once they've returned in the future, then I will purify the lips of the peoples that all of them may call on the name of the Lord and serve him shoulder to shoulder. From beyond the rivers of Cush, my worshipers, my scattered people, will bring me offerings. This is prophesying forward, and we see in Acts chapter 2, on the day of Pentecost, we see in chapter 2 of Acts, verse 11, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues. It's talking about on the day of Pentecost that all of these people had come together. How is it that we Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt and all the parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and converts to Judaism, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues. Amazed and perplexed, they said to one another, "What does this mean?" The day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2 is the reversal of the Tower of Babel in Genesis chapter 11. What happens in the natural realm at that time period in Genesis 11 scatters the people and scatters them into all these nations and tribes and subcultures and languages. But what Zephaniah prophesies and then happens inside the new covenant is that he brings them back together in tongues. He's bringing them all back together in the spirit. But there's something else to add to that in the sense that we still don't speak every language. We're still divided. But when we arrive in heaven, we'll know and be fully known. There's that language of love that's been given, which crosses all of those languages. Now, speaking on the supernatural side, I do know that in the 50s with the Latter Rain movement, there were people who literally packed their bags, moved to other countries, believed God would give them the native tongues of those countries, and there were quite a few that he actually did do that supernaturally. So there is an element like that. There is even today Sapreza, who works over with Heidi Baker in Mozambique. He has supernaturally learned, I believe it's 14 languages. He'll get in a boat, he'll row out to another location, get out on the ground, and as soon as he puts his feet on the ground, the Lord downloads to him the language of that people, and he can go in and minister to them. And he's seen many people raised from the dead, too. He is like an off-the-charts kind of individual. So I'm not discounting the fact that, yes, supernaturally we can cross language barriers and boundaries as well. But there will be another level as far as heaven as well. But this is a taste of it in Acts chapter 2 and what we see here of the flipping over. Last thought, in Genesis 11, it talks about that with one tongue as one people, nothing will be impossible for them. So when does he give back that one tongue as one people? He gives it back inside the new covenant to the kingdom people so that nothing will be impossible with them. That's for us. That's our stuff. Didn't want to give it to Babel, gave it to us. Gave it to Bethel. So we'll end with that. Thank you so much. Love you guys. Have a great week.